Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning. When Elizabeth and Steve approached me to talk about ethical dilemmas in healthcare in my career, the biggest challenge wasn't what I would talk about. It was, how could I do this in 10 minutes? So I'm going to give it a shot today. Let me start just by sharing a common Webster definition of what is ethics. It's a set of moral principles or a guiding philosophy. Potter Stewart, and I hope Paul will forgive me for quoting the Supreme Court Justice where he clerked, put it this way, ethics is knowing the difference between what you have a right to do and what is right. Kind of simple but profound statement. Knowing the difference between what you have a right to do and what is right. You could ponder that and talk about that forever, 10 minutes. Maybe Wynton Marsalis had it best, though. He said, ethics are more important than laws. And I believe they are. It's hard to imagine a richer context for ethical dilemmas than healthcare. Beginning of life, the end of life, termination of life, abortion, medical technology, the right to consent to medical procedures. And I faced all of those in my career. And I was there in 1973 when Roe versus Wade was passed. And I was happy to witness our board really did not agonize over what we were going to do. It was clear. This was the law of the land, and we were going to provide that important community service as a community hospital. But there are other kinds of issues that aren't, you know, so obvious. Access to health care. Is health care a right? Which I think it is, like education. Do all people get the same health care even if they have access to it? When you look at the disparities in longevity and health outcomes based on race and income, it's kind of shocking, quite frankly, in the richest country in the world. Now, in a lot of the medical ethical issues, we had physicians, we had attorneys, we had social workers, medical ethicists get involved, and I didn't usually get involved in those individual patient decisions, but I did in one instance, and it was kind of an interesting case. Early in my career, a young woman came to the hospital, needed surgery, and she was a Jehovah's Witness. And Jehovah's Witnesses do not accept blood transfusions. And this was a real concern for the surgeon, who felt that she really would need at least one unit of blood during the procedure, which was a serious medical procedure. And here's a young woman with two young kids. And the law was clearly on the side of recognizing the rights of the children in this case. And we had a legal right, we thought, to provide that blood. At the same time, we wanted to respect her privacy and her religious convictions. We also didn't want the Jehovah's Witness community picketing at the hospital. So I went up and talked to her about this and had a conversation with her after speaking with everyone involved and talked about why she felt the way that she did. And it became clear to me in this discussion that she really did not want to accept the blood based on her decision, but if someone else determined that she should receive the blood, she would accept it. And that's the course we took. I went to court, got a court order, and she accepted the blood during surgery. She did need it. She did well. There was no repercussions. And then I went up and talked to her afterwards just to see how she felt about it. And again, she felt that she respected her individual religious convictions, but the decision was taken out of her hands, and she accepted that outcome. So it ended well. Just a simple conversation, and sometimes conversation is the best way to resolve a lot of issues, including complex ethical ones. The bigger issues on ethics for me were not individual patient decisions, but really on economical issues. We were a not-for-profit institution. No mission, no margin was kind of the feeling in the not-for-profit world. You had to make profits so that you could reinvest in programs and people, et cetera. And there were plenty of ethical decisions in our annual budget. What services would we fund? Which ones would we not? How would we pay people? What benefits would we provide to employees? Simple ethical questions on health care for employees. We decided early on that people at the lower end of the economic scale at the hospital would pay much less for their health care than people at the high end. A simple ethical choice, so that we had a means test and people who could not afford the contributions and copays were not affected adversely. However, the one major dilemma that I faced probably in the 90s had to do with an issue that no one probably outside of the executive team even knew about until much later on. There was a loophole in the Medicare payment system for hospitals. No one knew about this arcane loophole except for very savvy consultants who were going around telling hospitals, you could make a lot of money if you just tweak how long patients stay in the hospital. If you keep them an extra day, instead of getting paid by Medicare a flat sum of money, they will go into another category of payment, and they will be considered an outlier. It's a whole outlier issue. Many hospitals decided to play this game, and it meant probably in Valley's case, it would have meant another $10 million a year, a lot of money to spend on other programs that were needed, helping people, giving people raises, et cetera. And the verdict from our attorneys was, it's not illegal, it's in a gray area, but we're not sure how Medicare will ultimately view this. And in approaching an issue like this, I would always kind of ask myself, well, it may be right to do, going back to Potter Stewart, but is it the right thing? And I would ask myself, what would happen if this issue made the front page of the local paper? How would people view the hospital? Would we lose our trust in the community? How would my family feel about this if they found out that we were gaming the system? So we decided not to play the game, did not play that loophole. And years later, the hospitals that did, and New Jersey was the biggest culprit in this gaming system. One hospital system had to pay back about $600 million over a course of a decade. $600 million. And I talked to the CEO about it. I said, how did you feel about that? He said, well, we made about $900 million on it, so paying $600 million, it didn't seem like a bad decision. And I said, well, maybe he's the smart one, and maybe I'm the sucker. But that was the kind of ethical judgment that we made, and to this day, I'm proud of it. However, apart from those decisions that I've briefly alluded to, I would argue that the biggest choices I made in my career were on the subject of ethical leadership. I'm a big fan of Frank Bruni. I don't know if anyone else is, but he had an article last week about the perversion of leadership by our current president. And to me, it just rang so true. And Bruni talked about leadership. He said, a leader articulates a clear vision and a set of principles and tells the truth. That's what leaders do. They tell the truth. I would add to that, a leader is the role model for the principles that we hold most true. Leaders inspire us. They create a vision. They give us hope for a better day. And they do this not by the choices and clear-cut decisions they make, but they do it through their actions and behavior. That's how we learn. We don't learn by listening or reading as much as we do. We learn by watching. That's how kids learn. That's how teachers teach. That's how leaders teach. They role model behaviors that are ethical and that are important principles. I can't tell you how many hospitals I go into, and they all have prominently displayed a set of their vision, mission, and values. We have our values or principles in the boxes that we did last week, the 7 principles. And the language is incredibly similar throughout a lot of the value statements that I see when I go into different hospitals. Quality, respect, integrity, truth, service, humility. And the values are meant to inspire us and kind of provide that ethical landscape, if you will. And then I walk through the institution, and I can tell that the culture is very different than the values that are espoused on those statements. And you say, well, what do you mean by culture? Every institution I go into has a unique culture. They're all different. And in many cases, they're set by the leadership team on how things really work. And the biggest problem that I think organizations have is when the values that are up on the wall and the behaviors are in contrast. And if they're mildly different, they're inconsistent. But if they're wildly different, I would say it's hypocrisy. Think about an institution that has a value statement on respect and a policy against sexual harassment. Meanwhile, the CEO is the biggest culprit of sexual harassment that you can think of. Think about evangelicals today, the values that they espouse and the behaviors that they're condoning. That, to me, is hypocrisy. And everybody in an organization gets it. The people that get it the most, I would argue, based on my own experience, are the people at the lower level of an organization. They're not fooled when there's a contrast between values and culture and how things really work. They know it immediately. I would ask also that we look at our own set of values and principles, and are there inconsistencies that we may have, or do our behaviors really support the principles? That's the acid test. Are the values just words, or are they really operational? So the role of a leader, I think, is paramount in creating that culture. It begins at the top and really has to be demonstrated every day. Now, I'm going to close with just a few of Azara adages. I'm running up against my 10-minute limit. It's often been said that integrity is doing the right thing even if no one is watching. It's a common one you hear of. My adage on that is everyone is watching. Assume everyone is watching. That's the best way. Don't think, gee, maybe I can get away with it, no one's watching, but assume everybody's watching, and you want everybody to see that behavior. Second adage is, which I've already alluded to, how would I feel if this decision or behavior made the front page of the local paper? Would I be proud? Or would I be embarrassed? How would my family feel about it? And the final adage is, I think most of us will be measured not by what we accomplish in life, how many assets we acquire, how big our portfolio is, what our resume shows. We're going to be measured by how we lived. Not what, but how. People will always remember the how of leaders. You'll constantly forget the details of their accomplishments, but you'll remember how they did it. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for giving me this opportunity to share some thoughts with you. Excuse me. First of all, I want to thank Rob Markowitz for reminding me of my mother. I haven't been that effectively guilt-tripped since she passed. Mike referred to a Potter Stewart for whom I worked in 1964-1965. Justice Stewart was popularly, principally known for a definition he gave of obscenity. And he said in Jacobellis versus Ohio, "I may not be able to define it, but I know it when I see it, and this is not it." So, we get an obscenity case in the term I'm working for Justice Stewart, and I have this definition of, excuse me, I'm sorry, going on, no. I had to ask Justice Stewart for some guidance, and he said he couldn't define it for me, but I said, well, can you at least describe it for me, which he did not do. But in any event, let's proceed to the subject of the talk, and that subject is an ethical dilemma that I faced, or dilemmas. I have faced and obsessed with one ethical dilemma, and that is the increasing inequality which characterizes the country. And I do think about it all the time. And the reason that I do is that I had a rather peculiar childhood. My parents were hard-pressed during the 1930s, and they became Marxists. And they were insistent, explicit, and they pressed their children and educated them in those values. The basic ethical principle which my parents taught me and my brother was that everyone is entitled to be treated equally. That all people are equal and they should be so treated. Now you might say, well, what's so different about that? Because after all, Thomas Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. Well, he was talking about political equality, the right to vote and the right to have your vote counted equally. The equality which we were taught as children was comprehensive. It was political, it was social, it was economic. It was put to me in a certain way which I never forgot. And that is, my parents said that you have no claim on anyone else's services or goods except to the extent that you have contributed to the public welfare. So think of it this way. If one works 40 hours a week, one is entitled to the services of others for 40 hours a week. That is what equality meant in our household. But think of how we live. realistically, how we live. To live as we do requires the contributions of hundreds of hours from other people. So it cannot be said that we are all equally treated. That is to say, we are privileged to an extreme degree. And in the value system of my parents, that was not justifiable. And so, having left Hamtramck and that society, we find ourselves in a situation where we are heavily privileged. Now, how can anyone justify that privilege? Because if it is in fact a privilege, that means not all people can enjoy it. And what is it that we should do in that situation? What can we do to somehow justify and be comfortable in the situation that we have? It's unrealistic to think that we can significantly affect the lives of all those unnamed others upon whom our lives depend. But I think it's something that we should be continually aware of, and I think it is something which should condition our relationships with those people who contribute to our livelihood. And I think it should also influence, if not control, what we do with our own resources so that we can contribute to the extent possible to make this a more equal society. Thank you for your attention.